Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado and I'll be your host for this episode. And today I'm so excited to talk to my friend, Dr. Fergus Rolston, about Belfast Punk and the Troubles and Oral History, published by Manchester University Press in 2022. Belfast Punk and the Troubles is an oral history of Belfast punk scene from the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s that explores what it was like to be a punk in a city shaped by the violence of the Troubles and how this differed from being a punk elsewhere. It suggests a critical understanding of sectarianism, subjectivity, and memory politics in Northern Ireland, and argues for the importance of placing punk within the segregated structures of everyday life described by the interviewees. Adopting an innovative oral history approach, the book analyzes a small number of oral history interviews in granular detail, looking at the punk scene as a structure of feeling shaped through the experience of growing up in wartime Belfast. Fergus Rolston is Chancellor's Fellow in the History of Activism at the University of Strathclyde. He is co-reviews editor of the Oral History Journal, and he's also a member of that journal's editorial board. His work focuses on how interpretative oral history and memory studies can illuminate people's affective and discursive relations to politics, place, and culture, generally in the context of the Troubles and the North of Ireland. Fergus, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks very much, Isabel. Thanks for having me.
So I usually start these interviews with a question that's something that I'm very interested in and curious about. How did this book come about? Or as I like to say it, what is your book's origin story?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question to start with. The book has got a fairly straightforward origin story, really. About 10 years ago, I was working in Manchester as a journalist and a copywriter. And I really hated my job and I really wanted to quit my job. And I read this book, which you might have heard of, by a guy called John Savage, which is called England's Dreaming. It's a brilliant book and it's about the punk scene in London. And I read this book and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to write a similar book about punk in Belfast, a similar book to that book, but about Belfast and about the kind of specificities of punk in Belfast, obviously in terms of the Troubles, as you said in your introduction there. That was the kind of impetus for the book, really. And initially my idea was to write something that was quite journalistic, I suppose, or something a little bit more like John Savage's book, which isn't really an academic book. But I guess then there were kind of two developments as the book progressed, which kind of shaped it into the direction that it's gone in. So first of all, a kind of increasing interest in the oral history dimension of the research, particularly via people like Louisa Pastorini and Alessandro Portelli. And then secondly, a kind of increasing interest in social history and memory studies in Northern Ireland. And that's kind of especially through the advice of a guy called Graham Dawson, who was my PhD supervisor.
A couple of things that I really enjoyed here for somebody who didn't know a lot about this history, right? You provide brief introductions to the history of the Troubles, but also to the history of the Belfast punk scene. I think that's a good place to start so that we can give some context to the folks that are listening. What makes the Belfast punk scene simultaneously be part of a transnational phenomenon, right? The punk scene that happened worldwide, but it's also a very particular story.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that one of the things that I wanted to get at in the book was the idea that although punk is sometimes kind of associated with like metropolitan centers like London or New York or whatever, it's got these kind of regional and international iterations happening at the same time. So some examples of the kind of transnational dimension of the Belfast punk scene that I really like. Brian Young, who's was the singer and songwriter of the great Northern Ireland punk band Rudy, used to write letters to Stephen Patrick Morrissey in Manchester before he became Morrissey and started the Smiths. And they used to write letters to each other, kind of talking about the scene in Belfast and the scene in Manchester. And then there's an example in the book of how this also works in a slightly later kind of anarcho-punk scene of the 80s. With Pete C. Burns' stories of visiting anarchist social centres and gig venues in Europe before he set up Gyros in Belfast and then started to invite British and European bands to play at their venue in Belfast. So, you know, I think records and publications and people and styles all kind of circulate globally, really, in terms of the punk scene. But I guess the second thing that I'm trying to get at in the book is that each of these kind of local iterations of punk are kind of responding to local material, social and cultural conditions. And that's the case with punk in Northern Ireland as well. I guess specifically in Northern Ireland, that's to do with the Troubles and with the kind of various effects and consequences of the Troubles, which is the war in Northern Ireland that took place from 1969 to 1998. And is another one of the kind of focal points of the book, really. I can get into the history of the Troubles a wee bit more later on if you like, but, very briefly, it's a kind of a late colonial war between the British state, a group of Irish people who want to secede from Britain and reunify with Ireland, and a group of Irish people who want to kind of maintain the union. And it's a sort of a 30-year war. There's about 3,800 deaths, hundreds of thousands of injuries. And particularly in Belfast, space becomes very sectarianized, very divided between Protestant, Unionist, Loyalist and Catholic Nationalist areas. And so the context for the punk scene, I guess, is that young Protestants and young Catholics both take part in it, which is relatively unusual in the context of the war.
As I mentioned, I didn't know a lot about this particular history, but reading your book made me think a lot about the particularities of the punk scene. I had the pleasure of experiencing a little bit in Salvador, Bahia, Brazil, and also your brilliant discussion of sectarianism and segregation made me think about my work with segregation in the U.S. South and the role of music and how music sometimes connected people. So that was great. Let's talk a little bit about the methodology, right? And in my introduction, I said that you use an innovated oral history methodology. So let's talk a little bit about that. You mentioned Passerini and Portelli. So tell me a little bit about your methodology, how you use the interviews, and why did you decide to use this particular methodology?
Yeah, it's kind of a big question. I think in some ways it's pretty straightforward. So the kind of oral history that I became interested in, which is sometimes called interpretive oral history, sometimes called kind of post-positive oral history, is a kind of a method that's interested in how people narrate their memories, as much as it's interested in the kind of content of the memories, if that makes sense. So there's a famous Portelli quote, which I think I use in the book, where he says that oral history tells us less about events than about their meanings. So about what they kind of mean in the present as they're being expressed by the narrator. And I think that's kind of the kind of oral history that I became interested in as I was doing the project. So there's an example in Portelli's work, a famous example of Luigi Trastulli, who's a factory worker in Turin. And Portelli interviews a bunch of workers in Turin about the death of this guy. And they all remember his death as being part of a big strike that happened, and that they won, where actually he died 2 years earlier, in a smaller kind of demonstration against Italian membership in NATO. And Portelli kind of says, well, it's interesting that all of these people misremember this, and it's a kind of a meaningful misremembering, like they're placing his death into a context that makes more sense, and that allows them to tell a more kind of coherent story of class struggle, of trade unionism or whatever. And I guess, yeah, that kind of sense that people are making sense of the past and of the present through their memories and through what they talk about in oral history interviews was kind of what I wanted to get at in my work. The other kind of big concept that I was thinking about there is sometimes called composure, which is Graham Dawson's concept. And composure is this kind of, it's got kind of a double meaning in the context of oral history. So on the one hand, it's to do with the fact that people compose as in write, or, you know, compose a song, compose whatever, kind of make up their memories, but they also try and find a memory that they're comfortable with, that they feel composed by, that they're able to feel comfortable with. And so that kind of sense of oral history as having this kind of subjective element was what I was interested in.
Yeah, that's what is really fascinating to me about your book, is that although the subject is really interesting, but you provide sort of ways of doing oral history that will definitely be relevant and interesting to people who are working with very different subjects. So that was great. Thanks for that.
That's really nice to hear, because I mean that's what I would love the book to do, really. I mean, in terms of the way I'm using the interviews, I guess it's kind of using one or two interviews at a time. That's maybe a kind of a slightly unusual way of using oral histories. And there's a few people who do it. I don't know if you know Daniel James's book about a Peronist meat worker in Argentina, which is a brilliant book, and it's based on a series of interviews with one woman. There's a woman called Leila Nezi, a Turkish oral historian who also tends to work with one or two interviews at a time, but it's not done that often, right? And I was kind of interested in trying to do that rather than kind of breaking the interviews up into chunks.
Not really related to that question, I just wanted to throw it out there, and that you also gave me an amazing playlist that I've been listening to since I started reading your book, so thanks for that as well. And how did you choose, right, since you're not using several interviews, how do you choose the people who you are going to interview for the project in general, and then how do you select whose stories and experiences are going to make it into the actual chapters?
Well, I mean, this is in some ways kind of an easy question to answer, because it was just, I mean, in terms of how I chose the narrators, you know, I don't know, it was just chaos. It's so hard to recruit for an oral history project. I'm sure you know yourself. Like I put lots of things on Facebook and on various kind of social media platforms. There's kind of punk heritage Facebook pages, and I got some interviewees from there. I put up lots of posters in sort of record shops and bars and clubs in Belfast. And I got a few interviewees from that kind of physical advertising. And then I just talked to people. I guess the social sciences call it like the snowball method, but, you know, just an interviewee would suggest a friend or an acquaintance who they thought might also want to be interviewed. And really I didn't get that many interviews. I think I did 14 or 16. So nearly all of the interviews are actually in the book. Apart from a handful of people who after the interview decided that they didn't want their interview to be used. So I didn't use them. I didn't archive them. And then in the first couple of chapters, I kind of refer to interviews with John T. Davis, who's a documentary filmmaker, and Brian Young, who I mentioned earlier, who's the songwriter of this band Rudy. And those interviews with John and Brian are good, I guess. I mean, they're interesting interviews, but I kind of had this idea that I didn't want to write too much about people who had some degree of celebrity from being involved in the punk scene, people who've been interviewed before, people who have been in magazines, people who've, been on the telly. I wanted to kind of keep the book focused on people who were involved in the scene, but not in a kind of public way. So that's why I didn't use John and Brian's interviews in the same kind of expansive way as I used the other ones. But yeah, I mean, apart from that, I mostly just used all the interviews that I got of the people who were willing to be used, because I didn't actually manage to do that many interviews in the end. So it's a fairly straightforward answer.
So one concept that it's really important here that you use in a few of the chapters, and that was something that really I found really interesting and thought about how it applied to, you know, my work, is structures of feeling. Tell us what it is first, and how does that idea, that concept, frame your analysis of the interviews here?
Yeah, thanks. So structure of feeling is a sort of coinage by the British Marxist and literary theorist Raymond Williams. And I guess for Williams, it's a way of talking about what he calls shared experience in solution. So the kind of lived relations as they're lived. And for Williams, they're kind of found in literary texts mostly. He's talking about how you can kind of find these in novels and things like that. But some recent historians of punk, so Matt Worley, David Wilkinson, John Street, used the idea of structure of feeling to talk about the punk scene. And I kind of got the idea from them, really. But with them, they a bit like Williams, they kind of, their analysis is quite textual, right? Like they write about zines, they write about the sleeves of records, they write about the lyrics of records themselves, but they don't do oral history interviews. So I was kind of interested in how you could take this structure of feeling idea and bring it into conversation with some of the kind of theories and ideas of oral history. So in the book, I guess, for me, it's about trying to get a kind of shared, collective, effective, felt experience that the interviewees are all kind of describing in different ways. And it's about understanding how that shared experience was formed in the context of Northern Ireland or the Troubles or whatever. I guess without getting too like deep into the thickets of Marxist theory, which we definitely don't want to do. I think for Williams, what's at stake in using this idea is that he wants to say, like, these relationships are shaped by material conditions, so the kind of bias in Marxism and the kind of bias superstructure model, but they're not completely determined by them. So he's kind of trying to talk about how economic conditions and things like that shape experience, but they don't determine them. And I kind of, that idea about like the context, like the Troubles, shaping my interviews experiences, but not completely determining them. I think that's kind of what I wanted to get at with the structure of feeling idea, if that makes sense.
Yes. When we think about the Troubles, of course, sectarianism and segregation come to mind, right? But you write here that the nature of punk's intervention in the structures of sectarianism and segregation is complicated. And I think that's an important contribution that your book is doing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So I think there's sort of two things to say about that. So the first way in which it's complicated is, I think, to do with my own, as a historian, my own reading of the conflict in Northern Ireland. So I guess I think there's maybe a slightly naive reading of the Troubles, and a reading that kind of predominates in public culture in some ways, that views it as this kind of predominantly sectarian religious conflict, as being this kind of atavistic, weird, like religious war that's kind of inexplicable in the context of the modern secular liberal world. That's kind of one of the hegemonic readings of the Troubles. And I guess I think that that's a reading of the Troubles that kind of elides or conceals the colonial roots of the conflict, and also the critical role of English colonialism in Ireland, and tends to think of contemporary Northern Ireland as having these kind of interpersonal sectarian antagonisms which need to be broken down. And I guess I don't think that's the right reading of the situation. So in terms of the punk scene, I felt that constructing it as this kind of magical space of cross-sectarian friendship and sociality kind of supported that hegemonic reading of the conflict. And I was keen to kind of avoid that. So that's one thing. And that's kind of driven by my own feelings or my own analysis of the Troubles. But then the second thing beyond that, I think, was that just in doing the interviews, like in conducting and listening to the interviews, I felt that the interviewees offered a much more kind of nuanced and messy view of what being a punk in the context of the war was like. They were kind of very attuned to limits and to tensions and to difficulties, whether that's to do with, like, you know, walking through certain parts of the city and not feeling safe, or talking about punk as being this kind of temporary space, but it doesn't get rid of the kind of structures of sectarian discrimination and violence and so on. Or talking about kind of arguments and disagreements within the scene itself, about class and gender and sexuality, as well as sectarianism. So there's that kind of sense from the interviews. And then at the same time, there's this kind of sense that they did conjure up this structure of feeling that spoke to some kind of sense of an alternative way of living, alternative way of relating to each other in Northern Ireland. And I wanted to try and capture that possibility as well. So it's kind of tricky to stress, like, you know, limits and possibilities at the same time. But that's kind of what I wanted to do in the reading of the interviews. There's a guy called John Nagle who's writing a book at the minute about the history of kind of, or the genealogy of kind of anti-sectarianism in Northern Ireland and how that's actually like a super complicated thing. No one really knows what sectarianism is a lot of the time, or people talk about sectarianism, but they can't really define it. So calling something anti-sectarian, I mean, how can you explain what that is if you don't even know what sectarianism is in the first place, right? So John Nagle is writing a book about that, which I think will be interesting. I hope that answers your question. Sorry, that was a bit of a...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, yes, it does. That was great. And I'm really interested in how or where history is done, right? Mm. Especially when it's done outside of traditional academic settings. So I was curious when I read here, when you write that the first historians of punk were the punks themselves. So I wanted you to talk a bit about that. And something that you mentioned here, how has the popular memory of punk been mobilized in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, thanks. It's a good question. I'm glad that you like that line, because I like that sentence myself. And I like that idea. I guess I was thinking there, I think I cite her work in the book, but I was thinking of the work of people like Red Chidgley on zines as kind of sites of popular memory. And then of stuff like record collecting and things like that as well. This kind of Raphael Samuel idea that collecting is a form of history, which I talk about a little bit in the final chapter with Gareth. I do think that's true, that these kind of, see, all kinds of scenes, not just punk. I mean, I think all kinds of cultural, subcultural scenes are kind of historicizing themselves all the time, right? I think even with the kind of punk thing, you've got this, punks are always saying, oh, this is punk, but this isn't punk. This is punk, but this isn't punk. And I think that kind of like delineation is very kind of historical in a way, or it feels like listening to historians at a conference or something, you know?
Yes.
In terms of the popular memory of punk, I would say that I think I kind of get into this in the book, but I guess there's like, it feels to me like there's two sort of waves of popular memory of punk. There's one that occurs around the publication of It Makes You Want to Spit, which is this amazing kind of collectively authored book about the punk scene in Belfast. And there's some kind of revival gigs and things like that that happen around the time that book comes out. That's just after the peace process. So there's a kind of an optimistic sense there. And I think the memory of punk is kind of enlisted in that kind of moment of optimism. And then a few years later, something I talk about quite a lot in the film is the film Good Vibrations, which is this kind of biopic of Terry Hooley, which is very successful, and which brings a new kind of wave of like visibility to the popular memory of punk, I guess. And the film was interesting because it came out just as I was starting the research for the book, really. So my interviewees talked about that a lot and kind of measured and analyzed their experiences in relation to the way that the scene was represented in the film. So I think that was a really significant kind of intervention in the kind of popular memory culture of punk. And I guess the final thing to say about that is that all of those kind of instances of that popular memory are fundamentally connected to the kind of contested memories of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, in a kind of complicated way. So I think, you know, there's still lots of kind of unsettled questions about how the war is remembered and represented and talked about and thought about in Northern Ireland. And I think all of those representations are kind of part of that to some extent.
Yeah, that idea that representations, right, popular culture, or the sorts of media, how they affect memory, that was really interesting to read and, again, to apply to it in other contexts. But I think the chapter that resonated the most with me is chapter 5, because, as you know, I study gender and sexuality. And you show here how, and I'm quoting you, punk is remembered as challenging hegemonic discourses on gender and sexuality in Northern Ireland. But you also show, the ways in which punk was complicit in elements of the socially conservative nature of Northern Irish society, or at the very least, unable to escape it. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. I'm glad that you, I think that's maybe my favorite chapter as well. It's the one that I wrote completely new for the book. So I feel it's the one that I still feel the most enthusiastic about, I think. I think in terms of the question of gender and sexuality in the punk scene, David Wilkinson, who I mentioned before, has written really well about this in the kind of English context, about the kind of how punk uses various kinds of transgressive sexual imaginaries, but sometimes can be quite regressive in the way that it uses them. But how at the same time it does also create these kind of potentially liberatory spaces. I think David talks about the Buzzcocks as an example of that, and the Buzzcocks' involvement in kind of gay liberation activism in Britain. The context for this in Northern Ireland, I guess, is the argument that various kind of feminist thinkers, including Begona Aretzaga and Fidelma Ash, have made about the kind of specific forms of like militarized masculinity that exist in Northern Ireland, partly as a consequence of the Troubles. So there's a sense that there's maybe a particularly kind of potent form of like societal kind of misogyny, really, that kind of runs through, Northern Irish culture in all kinds of ways. And I guess what I was trying to get at in that chapter through my conversation with Hector in particular is that you kind of get a sense that on the one hand, the punk scene feels like it's sort of breaking those things down a little bit. It's supposed to have been a relatively safe space for gay and for queer people and for difference in general, for like non-conventional performances of masculinity and stuff like that. But then on the other hand, I think it's probably still shot through with misogyny and heteronormativity and so on. And I think that kind of comes out in the other interview, in that chapter to some extent. And even in kind of Hector's interview, I think you've kind of got these two or three at least different discourses of masculinity kind of running through it, which I love that interview with Hector. That's my favorite interview that I did. I think he was such a lucid and thoughtful and very charming interviewee. I really enjoyed speaking with him. I think it's kind of a contested site for those kind of discourses. Of course it is. And I'm sure you've come across similar things in your own work. And I guess you can see the kind of liberatory or radical dimensions, but you can also see the conservative or the regressive dimensions.
Exactly. And one thing that I love reading in that chapter, and I think that's something that I hope more people are paying attention to, is the idea of the gay bar as the space that welcomes all sorts of misfits. Right. I study queer history, and in different places you've encountered this, not just a safe queer space, but also for people who do not fit in some way or another. So I'm very curious, as you know, I'm about to publish my first book as well. So I'm really, I love asking people about the small and big decisions that they make when they're writing their books. So why did you decide to wait until the conclusion to talk about yourself, right? To put yourself on the book and talk about your own experiences and how, you know, you related to the punk scene?
This is a super interesting question. I've been thinking about this since you sent me the list of questions. I've been thinking about this. And I'm actually curious to hear what you think about this as well. So the first thing to say is that I think that the way I've written about the interviews, the kind of working with one or two interviews, making the kind of dynamic of the interview quite present, right? I think that doing that is an attempt to make myself visible in the analysis in a way, although that might not always be totally explicit. So there's examples. I was thinking of the bit in my interview with Alison Farrell where she talks about being from Dungannon. And I say that there's a little bit of a kind of intersubjective moment there because I'm also from a kind of a small town in Northern Ireland. And there's a kind of bit of recognition between us there of what it's like to be from small towns in Northern Ireland, the kind of the visibility that any sort of difference brings down upon you. There's a bit in the interview with Pizzi where I talk about filling a silence kind of awkwardly by talking about how I don't like the band Crass. And then he talks about how much he likes Crass. So there's kind of moments in the analysis where I'm trying to make myself present, but not entirely visible, I suppose. And then the conclusion where you mentioned, I kind of talk a little bit more about myself. The conclusion, I guess, is an attempt to bring the analysis forward to the present and to try and think about what it means to write this history of punk in the kind of conjuncture of contemporary Northern Ireland. And that just seemed like a kind of an apposite place to bring in a wee bit of myself and my own experiences. But I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about it on my flight. I'm in Belfast right now, so I just flew to Belfast and I was thinking about it on the flight. I think maybe, you know, the book comes out of the PhD and in general, I'm kind of uncomfortable with the model of reflexivity that's sometimes imposed on you in a PhD context where you kind of give a laundry list of features about yourself and then you call that like oppositionality or whatever. And I wanted to try and thread it through the interviews a little bit more subtly. So that's the kind of like positive reason for waiting until the conclusion. And then in terms of a negative reason, I think there's probably also a degree of kind of reluctance. I was thinking my colleague, Andrea Garcia Gonzalez writes about discomfort in research. And I think there's probably a little bit of discomfort going on there as well. You know, I guess my training, such as it was as a historian, at Trinity in Dublin. It was quite a traditional, kind of history degree, very much about kind of absenting yourself from the analysis. And I think that I'm trying to resist that to some extent. Reading people like Tina Camp, C.J. Hartman, even Louisa Passerini in her brilliant book, Autobiography of 1969, kind of brings herself in a really interesting way. But there's definitely a kind of anxiety about resisting that kind of absence, you know? So I think there's like a reluctance thing there as well, if that makes sense. But I don't know what you think about that.
No, I really feel you, and probably ask me that again when I publish my second book, because this one, my current book is pretty interdisciplinary, so it was sent to different people. I kept moving it to the beginning, to the end of the book. That's why I was so curious about your decision. Now it's sort of like there's like a prologue where I talk about myself. But I feel you.
Yeah, I mean, I had a few iterations of the book where there was a prologue where I talked about myself as well, and maybe some of that stuff that's in the conclusion now I brought to the front. But I decided, I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to figure out how to do it, right?
Yes. Well, speaking of second books, before we go, do you have anything new that you're working on, that you're going to work on next, that you're working on now? Maybe are you doing that? And are you doing research in Belfast? So tell us, what's your new project?
Okay. I'm not actually doing any research in Belfast. I'm going to speak at a seminar at Queen's about this research and about the special issue of the journal, the Oral History Journal. I started this new job at Strathclyde. So I've kind of the last few months have been basically just settling in there, doing a little bit of teaching. I have got a couple of, research plans, which are kind of ongoing, but which I haven't really started yet. So the first one is to do with social housing and particularly high rise housing in Northern Ireland. So there's people like Michael Rahman, Lynn Abrams, who've written really fascinating books about the kind of memory of high rise housing in Britain, in Scotland in Lynn's case, and London in Michael's case. But no one has really written about the specificities of high rise housing in Northern Ireland. Me and my friend Gary Gomez Alfaro published an article about Dillis and Rossville flats, two of the kind of biggest high rise developments in Northern Ireland, a couple of years ago. And we used kind of archive oral histories to do that, oral histories undertaken by other people. And I think I'd like to do a project where I do some interviews myself on the kind of memory of high-rise housing in Northern Ireland, particularly in the context of the kind of housing crisis in Europe and possibly the world, but certainly there's a housing crisis in Ireland. So I think thinking about this kind of like, the kind of ideas, what people wanted to do with the high-rise housing, why it didn't work, or what people felt when they lived there, why they felt it didn't work is kind of something I'd like to do. And that's my kind of, that's the big project that I've got kind of in train at the minute. And I've started to write some bids for that. And then the other one, I mean, I'm reluctant even to talk about it because it's still just a very vague idea, but I don't know if you, actually, there's no reason why you would have seen the news as a British thing, but it was in the news today that the British government has just approved a new mine in Cumbria, the first new mine in Britain for years and years and years.
There's been a big uproar.
Yeah, and there's been a big uproar from kind of green organisations, obviously. And in Ireland, in Tyrone, on the border between the south and the north of Ireland, in the Sperrins area called the Sperrins, very beautiful part of Northern Ireland, there's been this kind of ongoing struggle with an American mining company that wants to set up a gold mine in this part of the Sperrins. And there's an organization called Save Our Sperrins who've been kind of campaigning now for 10, 15 years to try and prevent that from happening. It hasn't happened yet, but it's kind of an ongoing struggle. And they've also made a lot of connections, kind of global connections with other people kind of resisting different forms of extractivism around the globe. This is why I say I'm reluctant to talk about it because it's still quite a vague idea, but I think I'd like to think about how oral history could kind of intervene in that topic. Whether it's possible to do oral history interviews in the context of something that's still kind of ongoing like that, does that turn you into, do you become a journalist or a sociologist? You're not allowed to be an oral historian anymore. I don't know. But I've been following that story quite a lot, and it's, I think the kind of transnational, actually, to go back to transnationalism, the kind of transnational dimension of it is really interesting to me. So I'd be thinking about that as well, but that's still very much in the kind of back of the beer mat stage.
Yeah, both projects are fascinating, but I'm living in Vancouver, so I know a thing or two about housing crisis.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Yeah, I really want to read anything you write about that. And I hope you'll come back when you have a new book.
I'd be very happy to.
And this has been such a treat to be able to talk to you about this. I've been, you know, I followed a bit of your process and I've been waiting for this book to come out, looking forward to reading it. So, well, thank you so much for taking the time, you know, your busy trip to talk to me about your book.
No, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. It's been really nice.
And to the folks listening to us, thank you for tuning in to this episode of the New Books Network's podcast. I just spoke with Fergus Rolston about Belfast Punk and the Troubles, an oral history. It was published by Manchester University Press in 2020. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.